It is indeed a great occasion to open our project here with so many friends, and I want to thank you all for turning out for this event. I also want to thank Rob and the Keston family for creating Home for Me in what I think is an area of research that we desperately need to pay a lot of attention to. I'd also like to thank Michael and Ken and Lorne for joining me here in my first kickoff event here at the Washington Institute. When Rob suggested I make a discussion of the Bush legacy on democracy promotion in the Middle East, the subject of this event, I was initially skeptical. I didn't want to pigeonhole our new project as dealing exclusively or even primarily with democratization per se. But the more I thought about it, and the more I attended events around town in which it was being soundly, routinely criticized, I decided that it was necessary to confront the issue head on, especially as I was convinced, am convinced, remain convinced, that if we are to be victorious in the war of ideas, democracy, shorthand for a set of robust institutions that provide accountability by the governed to those who govern them, that democracy will remain a powerful counter to radical ideology, and that the other aspects of our future research in Project FICRA will all reinforce this bottom line idea, notion, that expanding freedom, liberty, is in our nation's long-term national security interest. First, a quick word about me. I've been involved with democracy promotion in one form or another around the world for the better part of my professional and adult life, mostly in the field. I've had the great privilege, as Rob mentioned, of working with the International Republican Institute. For the past 6.5 years, I've worked with the administration to bring the Freedom Agenda, as it's come to be known, to life. First as a Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, where I was privileged to work for then Assistant Secretary Lauren Craner, then in Iraq under the leadership of Ambassador L. Paul Bremer, and for the last 2.5 years as the Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Near East Bureau responsible for our efforts to promote reform in Arab countries. Here I'd like to stop and just mention that my successor is here in the audience, and I wanted to welcome him, specifically Patton, who I think began his job on Monday. So thanks for being here, Kent. Because of my experience, my perspective is not particularly or primarily a theoretical one, but one based on and tempered by my experience in both the field and in government. I would not consider my perspective to be Pollyannish or naive or overly optimistic, whatever the labels have been, but would instead place it squarely in a real realism and in a tradition of Burkean conservatism. Like Burke, I believe that sometimes in order to preserve a system, you need to evolve it. Without that evolutionary change, one is left only with sharp breaks, like revolution, as in the case of 1979 Iran, or as in the case of Iraq and possibly again in Iran, war. And so it should come as no surprise to this group that I'm committed to this agenda despite its recent challenges. Because I only have a few minutes, I'll be ambitious and try to make 10 quick points. 5 on where I think we got it right, and 5 on where we could have done better, leaving the rest for Q&A. Let me begin with where I think we got it right. 1, we correctly identified the problem and determined to do something about it. No longer could the stagnation of Arab countries and their demographic time bombs keep us from adding internal governance to the list of agenda items for our autocratic friends. There was a clear recognition that our best long-term response to terrorist ideology and therefore security lay in supporting efforts of political and economic liberalization in Arab countries. We couldn't fight something with nothing, and democracy remains the best counter to radicalism. On this, the Bush administration should get full credit, and I think that reading the National Security Strategy of 2006 remains the best articulation of this view. Number two, we successfully, until now anyway, divorced progress on the peace process from the question of internal governance. For the first time, this administration refused to allow the conflict to be an excuse for ignoring political and economic reform. What, after all, did the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have to do with the inability of the government of Algeria, for example, to create a more independent parliament? Sure, resolving the conflict would accelerate reform, but not resolving it shouldn't give governments a bye. We crafted a holistic approach across the government, but particularly within the State Department, to advance the policy and sought to coordinate all foreign assistance to stimulate reform. The financial sector reform effort that was achieved in Egypt is a perfect case in point where all the elements of the U.S. government together with the government of Egypt worked to the benefit of all. Number four, we invested in a proliferation of tools to help advance the policy effectively, many that stressed economic liberalization as a component of democratization. For example, we launched the Millennium Challenge Corporation. The president launched the Middle East Free Trade Area. We expanded a number of bilateral investment treaties. We worked to get governments into the WTO, including the Saudi government, all with the intention of using carrots to stimulate reform. In addition, we launched the Middle East Partnership Initiative, which sought to advance reform in four different areas, all supporting the political reform agenda in economic reform, education reform, political reform, with a special focus and attention paid to women's empowerment. We also created the Human Rights and Democracy Fund within the Bureau of Democracy and Human Rights, and we sought and were successful in supporting large plus-ups for the National Endowment for Democracy. Number five, we recognized, perhaps slowly, the need for partners, but did initiate efforts to bring in the rest of the international community. The Community of Democracies, which was established under the Clinton administration, was continued and expanded. In 2004, President Bush launched, under the RG8 presidency, the Broader Middle East and North Africa initiative, and has since expanded that to other non-G8 countries, which include Turkey, Pakistan, Spain, a host of other European countries. The latter includes hundreds of non-governmental organizations that are participating with governments in discussion about the future direction of reform, which is a first for non-governmental organizations around the region to be sitting down with their governments and with governments of the G8 to talk about these issues. We also worked to establish the UN's new Democracy Fund, which has now started projects in a number of Arab countries and includes countries like India as the largest single contributor. Now for where we could have done better. I think the first point is the key. Our rhetoric outstripped our ability to implement. There can be no clear statement than the president's policy than his second inaugural address. But even beforehand, whether it was in the speech at the NED in November of 2003 or before that in 2002 with the establishment of the Middle East Partnership Initiative, it was clear that we needed a big bang to indicate that something had changed in U.S. policy. But the failure to effectively implement the policy undermined its credibility to many within the governments of the region, for their citizenry, and I would argue for the U.S. policy establishment. I think a contributing factor to this was the failure to push the president's clearly articulated policy strongly enough within our own bureaucracy. This was a huge paradigm shift, not only for the governments in the region, but for the State Department as well. And the administration didn't focus enough on the idea that policy is people. A deputy assistant secretary, matter how talented, needs top cover to advance the policy. This was especially true with respect to Egypt, and I see Kareem is here, and I'd love to come back and talk about that in the Q&A period if we have time. A sub-point here is that we were not consistent in our approach. In particular, the administration, despite the fact that it put a great emphasis on this policy and the president talked about it repeatedly, we did not find a way to harness DOD as a messenger. And as a result, we often sent conflicting messages to the governments we were trying to work with. As a result, for the same administration and occasionally the same ambassador, they came across as being schizophrenic. Tunisia, for instance, was either, depending on who you were talking with, a model or a basket case. So finding ways to engage both the military and security services should be a critical aspect of how we go about promoting democracy, and we haven't done it. Number two, we failed to develop until much later in the process individual country strategies that fit with the political and historical currents of each country. The policy was too generic at first for reasons we can discuss. But when the president called on in multiple State of the Union addresses for Egypt and Saudi Arabia to lead the way, we should have had more of an idea of where we wanted them to go and how we wanted them to get there, and probably had fuller discussions with them about that beforehand. Number three, we didn't and don't commit enough resources as a government to these efforts. We commit $1.3 billion to Egypt's annual defense. We're promising $20 billion to Saudi Arabia in terms of foreign military financing. We contribute to other aspects of the policy. By contrast, the Middle East Partnership Initiative, which, remember, is supposed to do all those four things I mentioned, economic reform, political reform, education reform, women's empowerment, in 23 countries across the Arab world, received in fiscal year 2007 $50 million. Karen Hughes, in the 07 supplemental request, got her full request, which was very good. For the entire world, it too was $50 million. No real effort was made to meet resources with priorities. Also, there was no creative effort to leverage resources from the private sector or from the Gulf in these particular areas. I mean, if we're going to support Fayyad's government, go to the Saudis. But if you're going to look to support education reform, no one thought about it until Mohammed bin Rashid of Dubai, on his own, announced a $10 billion fund for education, something that, again, maybe we wanted to talk to him about. Four, slightly controversial one. We allowed the freedom agenda and democracy promotion efforts to be caricatured and confused with regime change. Our interventions in both Iraq and Afghanistan liberated millions of people, and I shed no tears for Saddam's regime. But that sort of quick transition, sharp transition through a military intervention is not the template for fostering democratic development, and it is not the way in which most countries in the world have become democratic. Those who criticize the overall effort or our desire to promote democracy then used Iraq as the red herring to beat us over the head, and we let them. Number five, when it came to elections, we didn't figure out a way to apply the clear democratic principle that armed actors should not be allowed to participate in elections. On this, we basically screwed up. Pretty straightforward. We should have made clear, as has been done in other contexts, particularly Northern Ireland, that you cannot be part of the political process if you continue to carry weapons and threaten to use them. I think in large measure the comfort with allowing armed actors to participate in elections stemmed from Iraq. The argument that the January 2006 elections wouldn't be meaningful without Hamas echoed debates in Iraq prior to elections there. We let Skiri participate, for instance, and didn't think too much of it as a problem. We accepted their participation as a fact of life and hoped the electorate would keep the militia accountable. On this, we were naive. But that said, we cannot be left with the canard of promoting democracy without reflection or reference to elections, a view I'm hearing with greater frequency around town. But I'll, again, save that for the Q&A. A very quick note, and I've gone over, about going forward. There's little question that the issue of democratization in Arab countries will persist for whatever administration next takes the reins of executive power. As Haaretz noted yesterday, every presidential candidate agrees with the idea of finding ways to support democracy in the region. Well, every candidacy except for Kucinich, whose administration doesn't seem to be in the offing at the moment. For policymakers, therefore, it is not a question of strategy but of tactics. And since Lorne will be sharing his views on what the USG role should be, I'll simply note the dangers of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. If we should give up on the freedom agenda or whatever it's going to be called next, we have only then to remain stuck in our binary option box, being forced to choose between increasingly decrepit autocrats or face anti-democratic Islamists. We have to recognize that a continuum does exist in each country, and our policy should not be simply on or off, do nothing or send in the 101st Airborne. We are the world's largest superpower, and we at least should know what we want so we can manage toward that type of world that benefits not only us but the rest of the world. We should not, as some argue, become shy, retiring wallflowers, content to be gentle prodders of liberalized autocracy. We have to recognize that as an interested party and the world's largest superpower, I'll emphasize that again, we can work with Europe and others to pressure governments to take additional progressive steps that progress at something faster than geologic time. Abandoning the effort to support democracy will further undermine U.S. credibility among those who are starting to trust us. We need partners in the battle of ideas. And if those who are willing to fight it don't come to believe that we stand by what we say, they will give up, and it will be much more difficult to enlist them a second time. Since we don't have much time or many allies, this would clearly be a stupid thing to do. Finally, abandoning democracy promotion would be equivalent of waving the white flag in the battle of ideas. As I've already noted, you can't fight something with nothing. And holding up the standard of managed autocracy is not exactly motivational. People won't be fooled into accepting half measures forever. Sooner or later, they will demand real change. And hopefully, the U.S. will be on the right side of history when that change comes. Thank you very much.